Hello and a warm welcome to another episode of Inside VC, the podcast from Digital Compact. My name is Joel Kaczmarek, and next to me sits Christian. Hello, Christian.
Hello, Joel.
It's been a while. Actually, we just found out that we need to think about, like, what was the name of our format. So we didn't do that many recordings in the past, but this will change. And today we'll kick off with liquidation preferences.
Da passt auch mal wieder unser spannender Partner ins Bild, denn ich möchte euch heute 99 Designs vorstellen. Wobei, 99 Designs muss ich euch eigentlich gar nicht mehr vorstellen, denn wenn man ein Logo designen möchte, kommt man an den Jungs und Mädels eigentlich gar nicht vorbei. Was ist das? Eine Plattform, wo ihr sagen könnt, was hättet ihr gerne für ein Logo, was soll das kommunizieren, was für Vorstellungen habt ihr? Und dann hat 99 Designs eine sehr große Community, die das für euch tut. Das heißt, zahlreiche Designer geben euch Vorschläge, wie euer Logo aussehen könnte. Und gerade beim Thema Venture Capital, Investoren, ist das ja super spannend, wenn man jetzt mal an so Dinge wie ein Pitch Deck denkt, an eine eigene CI, die man schon haben kann. Also man kommt, glaube ich, deutlich professioneller rüber, wenn man da ein spannendes Logo hat. Wie das immer so ist, Onkel Joel hat für euch auch einen spannenden Discount-Code. Und zwar, wenn ihr auf 99designs.de, und das geschrieben mit Zahlen, ja, also 99designs.de/go/digital geht, kriegt ihr dort 25 Euro Discount und noch ein Powerpack on top im Wert von 99 Euro, also 124 Euro wert. Damit wird euer Logo-Wettbewerb noch einmal geboostet. Das heißt, ihr gebt weniger Geld aus und mehr Designer bewerben sich auf euer Logo. Schaut euch das mal an. Ich habe mein eigenes Logo dort auch entwickelt und es ist wirklich sehr, sehr toll, gerade auch wenn man beraten wird. Das solltet ihr auch durchaus wahrnehmen. Ich habe da viel daraus gelernt. So, aber zum Thema.
We are about to try to give an idea of what is a liquidation preference, why is it necessary, how can I structure it and what will I do with it if the development of my company isn't as hoped for. Maybe just starting off, like, what is a liquidation preference and why does an investor need it?
The liquidation preference, as the name implies, is a term that comes into play when the company gets sold. So when you have the what we call the liquidity event, basically the sale or exit of the company. And so fundamentally, the thinking behind it is that when you invest at a company in the, you know, in the venture world, you pay a valuation that takes into account the future option value of the company. So, you know, not something that's based off of cash flows or so, but really something that's basically assuming that the company is going to be successful minus a certain discount to basically credit for the risk. And so what you want to make sure is that if things don't go as planned and the company gets sold for a value that's below or significantly below the valuation that you have attached to the company at the time of your investment, that you don't end up not getting any money or getting only a fraction of your investment, while the common shareholders, so basically the founders or other investors that were invested prior to you, actually make money and have a positive return. So the idea is you want to protect yourself as an investor against a scenario where you lose money and others that have been inside the company previously make money.
So basically, an investor comes around and says, well, you know, I'm taking a certain risk by investing in you guys. In return, I would like to have some kind of safety that saves me from losing my money or not getting back as much as I invested. And ideally, I want 10 times the amount I invested.
Exactly. And the reasoning, very simply, is that you say, hey, guys, I'm willing to pay a price here that assumes that things are going to go well in the future, right? But in case we've been collectively wrong and things don't go well, and the company is sold for a value that's below even the capital that has been invested by us or, you know, whatever investor, then you want to make sure that at least you get your money back really before others start making money, which I think that is fundamentally a fair principle, because you don't want to have situations where you have a buyer stepping in and being able to say, you know, I buy the company for cheap and you, Mr. Founder, still make a good amount of money because you still own a big chunk of the company, and let's not care about your investors even if they lose half of it.
Speaking about Germany, yeah, German VC scene, are liquidation preference a standard like for quite a while, right from the beginning, or is it something that that came up over time?
So the liquidation preference tool is something that has been around since the 80s in the US. And so it's been around since the Wild West days in Germany in the 90s, where Germans have been very creative with weird terms. But I think liquidation preference is, in its true form, not one of them. So it's a standard tool that really was started in the 80s in the US.
I think this is important to give young founders, maybe first-time entrepreneurs, an idea that this is really a standard term that they should calculate with whenever they talk to a VC. And how is it solved technically? Like, what does happen if a VC comes to the table, a founder comes to the table, they start discussing and negotiating? How is this liquidation preference done, basically, in the contracts?
There are fundamentally two ways, but before I get into that, I think what you say is exactly right. If I look at a term sheet and you know, quickly want to get a sense for is this a deal that we want to do. There are about two or three things I look at, and liquidation preference is one, vesting is another, and then sort of the rest is economics, valuation, all that kind of stuff. But that's about it. So it is one of the two, three key terms for investors that you do want to have in place in some way, shape, or form. Now, having them in place, what does it mean? You can fundamentally have two different kinds of preferences. There is one that's called the fully participating liquidation preference, which confusingly for the German listeners is called the nicht anrechenbare liquidation preference. And so the fully participating liquidation preference, what it really means is that you basically take the invested capital off the top of the proceeds from a sale, and everything that remains after having paid back the invested capital to the investor, everything that remains after that, you then split according to the ownership in the company. So a very simple case, let's say somebody has invested $2 million in the company, you sell the business for, let's say, $10 million, then you first pay the $2 million back to the investor, and you then distribute the $8 million that remain according to the ownership in the cap table, and let's say the investor has initially bought 20% of your business, still gets those 20% of the $8 million. So in total, the investor would receive $2 million from his initial investment plus 20% of $8 million, so $1.6 million from the pro rata split. So that is why it's called fully participating, because you take your money off the top and then still fully participate in the distribution of proceeds after the liquidation preference has been served. There is another model that's called the non-participating, or in German, the anrechenbare liquidation preference, which basically is more of a downside protection. So what it effectively means is that as an investor, you either get your capital paid back or you participate in the pro rata distribution of proceeds. And you will typically choose what gives you more money. So if, let's say, you have invested $2 million and bought 20%, the company gets sold for $1.5 million because it really, you know, wasn't a successful exit, you first get paid out $2 million. There's only $1.5 million to really get paid out. So those go straight to you. In this case, you know, it's a no-brainer. You choose exercising the liquidation preference. Let's assume, however, the company gets sold for $20 million and you've bought 20%. You would get the $2 million, which is identical to the capital that you've paid in if you went for asking for the liquidation preference, or you get 20% of $20 million, so $4 million if you go for the pro rata distribution. In that case, you know, basically the effect of the liquidation preference is zero in any case where you would get more from the proceeds than of a pro rata distribution than just having your capital paid back. So it really means that if the company is successful, there is zero, let's call it penalty, to the founders or the other shareholders. If the company really is not successful, you have this downside protection where you really make sure that you're in a situation where you're losing money while others are making money.
Now, I learned that this fully participating liquidation preference is also called double dipping. I think this is a nice image, although investors probably do not like it. Like having the idea of dipping your hand into water and doing this twice, you know, twice as much water as possible. Now you just said either take the money out you invested or participating in your pro rata proceeds. So far, we only spoke about 1x liquidation preferences, if you like. What is standard here? I mean, quite often it also happens that investors ask for more than once the amount invested.
Putting a multiplier on the liquidation preference, you start entering the territory of really, let's say, optimizing the economic terms along different dimensions. So, for example, some founders really want a very high valuation of their businesses for whatever reasons, equity story reasons, optics. And then sometimes you say, hey, okay, that's fine. We'll pay a very high valuation, but you give us a 2x participating liquidation preference. So you basically lock in a base return for any scenario that's, you know, a reasonable outcome. You know, on the other side, you pay the higher valuation. So what it really means is that basically you get a multiplier on your invested capital. So if you have a 2x non-participating, and let's stay with the same example, you would have paid in $2 million, then you don't only take $2 million off the top, you actually take $4 million off the top. There is another model where you put an interest rate on the preference, where you say, hey, every year this preference grows by an interest of, you name it, 10%. Both of those are sometimes done in later stage deals where sort of this valuation play becomes more relevant. I personally would only do those in, very special situations. Usually our goal is to keep it very clean and simple and sort of not make the liquidation preference a tool of economic optimization, but really restricted to its original purpose, which is basically a downside protection tool.
Yeah, I mean, we're also trying to give young founders an idea of which liquidation preference does make sense when, or as you just said, sometimes this may be an instrument to negotiate with a different strategy, basically. As you said, sometimes a higher valuation makes sense in return for a more aggressive liquidation preference. What is your standard here? I mean, what would you recommend to young founders? What is the, not ideal maybe, but a fitting liquidation preference strategy?
Yeah, so I would always lean towards really keeping it simple. And that's mostly really for two reasons. One is that it then basically really accurately reflects the state of the company. Because, for example, optimizing for high valuations can really have a negative impact on your next fundraising round. If you haven't achieved quite as much as you had hoped, you're in a situation where you're looking at a flat round or possibly a down round, which can really make fundraising very hard and painful and shuts out a lot of investors who are not willing to go through the pain of pricing a down round. So I would always counsel people to keep things sort of relatively straightforward and not do too much, let's say, financial engineering as part of a venture round. And what that then means is you basically try as a founder and go for the non-participating liquidation preference, so no double dipping, as you nicely called it, because that is, and that's the second reason, that's sort of the simple downside protection. That's keeping it very straight. And that helps you in future financing rounds, because the one argument I think that's sort of the strongest on the side of the founders is that whatever you give to the guy who comes in the Series A or even in the seed round in terms of liquidation preference is going to be the minimum that the next guy who comes in the next round is going to ask for. So we call this establishing precedent, right? And if you're setting the precedent that you're giving somebody a fully participating liquidation preference, it is very unlikely that you can convince the next investor to not get the same type of structure. So the more you keep it simple, the more you keep it plain vanilla, the better it is for follow-on financing rounds, because you can just tell everybody, hey, the docs are clean, no special rights, preferences, whatever. It's really all standard.
Quite often you see these legal terms with class A shares, class B shares. This is how this is solved from a legal perspective. And sometimes this can get really, really messy, because what you just said is basically stack mechanics, right? Mm-hmm. If investor one has this and that liquidation preference, the second one wants one alike, basically, maybe even a harder one. What's your view on this? How can I control this aspect? And maybe we should also say one sentence about this famous last in, first out, because mm-hmm. unexperienced business angels would also say, hey, I'm the guy taking the biggest risks here. Why am I the last one to be paid out via liquidation preferences?
Exactly, yeah. That's a very good point. Let's take that first. I think the way the mechanics really work is that you say whoever gets in first also pays the lowest price. Your position in the liquidation preference stack is based on when you invested and the price you got at the time. So the logic is that whoever comes in last paid the highest price. And because of that, the risk of failure really should be the lowest. So if the company isn't successful and the liquidation preference scenario kicks in, the guys who came in last get their money out first because they, in a way, overpaid the most. That's what the logic is here, because people, while initially they take the highest risk, they also, in a typical structure, paid the lowest price. And that's why there is this, what we call stack, as you said, where basically it's last in, first out. Whoever paid in last sits on the top of the liquidation preference stack and the others are kind of stacked below that. So you really have, let's say, a hierarchy of payouts. And so, if the proceeds are very low and they only pay back, let's say, the last round investment, then that's the lucky guy. Right. If they're, low, but enough to pay back all the paid in capital, all the guys are going to get their money back. There are situations where you flatten this stack and you put everybody on the same footing. That's what's called a pari passu. So in lockstep preference. But typically it is the stacking. And we in Germany, for example, solve this usually through a waterfall where in the documents you basically say, investors who hold the shares from this round, get their money first, then, from the previous round and so on. In the US, this is done via the share classes with the different preferences attached to the different series of shares. That's really something you want to be mindful of if you have US investors coming in, because they are going to be very surprised, and maybe that's a topic for another podcast, but not to get preferred shares, or, you know, understanding that we actually don't have preferred shares, but we can create the same economic structure by putting in the right provisions in the shareholder agreement. So kind of having a lawyer who can translate to US investors how the German structure mirrors what they're used to in the US is very, very important.
Mm. As you said, one of the things you look at when checking out an investment is liquidation preferences. What do you look for, basically? Let's say you have a company that had a seed round, a Series A, maybe also a Series B, and you are the guy coming into the next round. What do you look for on liquidation preferences? Is just the simple aspect of, is it a 1x or 2x liquidation preference, or is the other stuff as well?
The logic is very simple. If we feel the valuation is fair, we typically go for a non-participating, you know, straight liquidation preference, no bells and whistles. That also has the advantage, which is an important point, that when we think that there are going to be a number of follow-on rounds, we don't want a lot of money sitting in front of us in that preference stack. And if, you know, we won't be able to avoid that because other investors, for the same reasons we ask for it, will at least ask for a non-participating preference as well. However, then that only becomes relevant in the downside case, but doesn't reduce our return in a successful case because you don't have the double dipping. So we, as an early stage investor, over time become more and more aligned with the founder, because our share class is sort of more similar to theirs in a way than, you know, the ones of the late stage investors. So it's in our interest to not put in things that hurt what we call the common shareholder or the founders too much, because, you know, we're very close to them in the stack at the end of the day. So we'll typically just ask for the non-participating preference if we feel the valuation is fair. If you get a scenario where we feel we are paying a very high price, then sometimes we ask for this participation, or if previous investors already have it, yeah, mm-hmm. then of course we ask for it too. But typically we don't. One compromise that you often see, that's what I would, you know, recommend to founders if they find themselves in a situation where they have an investor they like, but that investor is very focused on getting a participating preference. One very good compromise is that you say, look guys, you can get the participation for any event where your return is less than a, insert your multiple here, of the investment, typically 2x, 3x, you know, that type of return. And you say, if you only, quote unquote, make 2 or 3 times your money, you can do the double dipping. We give you sort of this extra kicker because we're all sitting here assuming you will get a 10x or something. If that doesn't work out and it's a small exit, we give you this extra kicker, this double dip. If things go well and you make a 10x, why should you get that kicker? Yeah, it's going to be mostly immaterial. It doesn't make a big difference for you. So then let's waive it. So basically you say, you put what we call a cap on the preference, in the sense that once you hit that multiplier, let's make it 3x, the preference participation really goes away. That's, I think, is a very good compromise. It incentivizes the management to seek for large exits, which is what you want as an investor, and still gives you as an investor who's paid a high price some level of downside protection if the exit isn't very large. So I think that's usually a fair compromise in situations where you kind of have the two camps, you know, pitted against each other.
Yeah, I think this is a nice picture. Like you have the downside protection for the investors, then you have the motivation aspect for the founder as well, because, you know, founders often, I think, have this nightmare of, okay, I'm doing a 10 million exit and only see 800K of this or even nothing. This is the aspect a founder may think of. And then you had this aspect, as you said, hey, you know, thinking in this last in, first out logic, you might be interested in not having a fully participating LICPREF in the beginning. Is it possible, by the way, to change this over time if the first investor had this and the second one doesn't want it?
It's unlikely that the second one doesn't want it. What you can do sometimes is you can negotiate it away with the new investor in, let's say, your second round of financing and say, hey, you only get the non-participating. And then you go back to your inside investor and say, hey, this guy is willing to invest on non-participating terms. You should waive your participation.
Mm. Yeah, waiving is a good keyword here. This is actually the last aspect I wanted to ask you about. Let's think of a fuck-up case. if the company is sold, yeah, so it's not a total disaster, it doesn't went for bankruptcy, but it is sold for a price that's like rather small. Is there a possibility for an investor to say, hey, I'm waiving this preference, or, you know, giving some kind of compromise to a founder?
Yeah, no, there always is. I mean, you have to distinguish between two situations. One, I think, is where a company has a solid business but has taken on a lot of capital, and it would become obvious that management is no longer really incentivized because it's going to be very hard for them to create a return that exceeds all the capital that's been invested. One example that I believe is, you know, has been discussed quite publicly is the recent financing round for Postmates, where they basically create a structure where the investors waive their liquidation preference on the past investment and only took a preference on the new money that came in order to not basically put the bar for management too high, so that those guys would never be able to really see any of the money, because it's almost impossible for them to create an exit that, you know, will leave enough on the table for them after satisfying all the money that has historically gone into the business. So you have that over the life of the company where you say, okay, we recognize a little bit too much money has been gone in, you know, we went through a couple of changes and we kind of have to wipe out part of the preference. The other scenario is you bring in new management at, you know, a later stage of the company, or you come to the same recognition that you say, oh, too much money has gone in and we have to make sure the founders stay incentivized. And then you can create what we typically call a carve out, where you basically say X percent of the proceeds go to the founders or the CEO, whoever it is, kind of alongside all the preference. So think of it like a waterfall where every euro that comes in gets split in two parts, one that goes towards the liquidation preference and another part, you know, a certain percentage, 10, 20, whatever the carve out is, goes straight to the management. Yeah. So that's why it's called a carve out, because you sort of carve it out of the proceeds. So that those are, you know, there are a number of other tools that you can do, but nothing is ever set in stone. In fact, there is very high likelihood that if you invest in a Series A, that at some point in follow-on rounds, you know, these things get changed. But it is just a, let's say, hygiene factor that you try to put in the documents early on. And so that's why it's important to have it clean and simple. You create the right structure from the beginning and waste as little time as possible on renegotiating those points when you're raising follow-on rounds.
Cool. I think this gives us quite an idea of how liquidation preferences work. And I also like these wordings like carve out or double dips. That's really, you know, that gives a VC business a bit of the feeling of a nerd or a tech guy. You know what I mean?
Or a dinner party.
Yeah. I kind of like that. And I learned that we should do a podcast on how do I deal with American investors if I'm a German guy interested in American VC. So thanks a lot and see you next time.
You're welcome. Looking forward to it.
So, ihr lieben Zuhörer da draußen, das war es für heute leider auch schon wieder. Ich hoffe, ihr konntet einiges für euch mitnehmen und hattet Spaß beim Zuhören. Seid doch bitte so lieb und schenkt uns eine Rezension mit 5 Sternen bei iTunes und abonniert uns natürlich auch in der Podcast-App eures Vertrauens, gerne auch bei iTunes direkt. Und wir freuen uns riesig, wenn ihr unseren Podcast auch an Freunde und Kollegen weiterempfehlt, weil uns liegt wirklich am Herzen, unser Wissen mit vielen anderen zu teilen. Auf Facebook findet ihr uns ebenfalls, dort unter facebook.com/digitalkompakt.